today on Against the Grain. What stands in the way of the urgently needed transition to clean energy? What is energy democracy, and what role can it play in the struggle against fossil capitalism? I'm CS. We'll re-present a conversation with Ashley Dawson about his book, People's Power, Reclaiming the Energy Commons, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. If renewable energy sources like solar and wind are the answer, if a swift transition to clean energy is not only desirable but necessary, how do we get there? Why are big utility companies so reluctant to move toward renewables? Why do status quo economic imperatives favor the perpetuation of fossil capitalism? According to Ashley Dawson, energy democracy is the way forward. Unless people actively and proactively take control of the grid, without a collective struggle to take back the grid, energy business as usual will move us ever closer to environmental destruction. Ashley Dawson is a longtime climate justice activist and professor of postcolonial studies at the Graduate Center, City University of New York, and the College of Staten Island. He's also the founder of the CUNY Climate Action Lab. Ashley's new book is People's Power, Reclaiming the Energy Commons. When Ashley joined me recently, I asked why he titled his book People's Power.
Well, because at the moment, the dominant definition of energy is as a commodity that is controlled by markets, which means that we, in fact, are not in control of our energy supplies. Big investor-owned utilities tend to be where the majority of people in the United States get their power from. And we're not making energy transition to renewable energy. So the book argues that we need people power, that we need a democratization of control over energy, and we need to push for energy supplies and sources that benefit the commonwealth and that are a form of commonwealth if we're not to keep fossil capitalism dominating our lives and cooking the planet.
Can a transition, a meaningful transition to renewables be achieved without energy democracy?
No, CS, I don't think that we can make a transition to renewable energy in time if we stick to the existing system of private control of energy. Right now, investor-owned utilities have massive stocks of stranded assets. You know, they have coal-fired power plants and fossil gas power plants, and they don't want to let go of those investments. They'll really damage their balance sheets. And in addition, they also have a for-profit structure that ensures that they are funneling huge amounts of money to their CEOs and to their investors instead of putting all of that money into a transition. So, while we constantly hear about the capitalist market pushing us towards renewable energy, it's actually not happening nearly as fast as it needs to. We have less than 10% renewable energy right now in the U.S. grid, and the amount of renewable energy, globally speaking, is even lower. And we know from climate scientists that this is not nearly where we need to be, and we're not making moves towards a transition nearly fast enough. So people really need to rise up and take control over the energy transition. And the way they can do that is by fighting for energy democracy.
And just so we get our terms straight, what are the various types of renewable energy out there?
Sure. So the most important forms of renewable energy are solar power and wind power. And then there are other less consequential forms like geothermal power, for instance, or power from the tides. But one kind of controversial element of the renewable energy package, something that I wouldn't consider one of the genuine renewables, is hydropower. In other words, power from large dams. In general, that form of energy comes with really significant carbon emissions. When you put up a big dam, you have to flood a lot of land behind it, and that usually means flooding lots of forests, and the trees decay, releasing significant amounts of carbon. And with those carbon emissions, of course, also comes, in most cases, massive displacements of people and animals and, you know, death of forests, as I already said. So there are human rights atrocities involved, but also continuing carbon emissions. So the last few decades have seen a real battle around dams and a pretty successful triumph against the idea that hydropower should be included in modern renewables. But the fights are still not over. In New York City, for instance, our mayor, Bill de Blasio, recently proposed to power all municipal buildings with green energy, but the plan is to get that energy from dams up in Quebec. And that would mean putting a giant cable all the way down the Hudson River Valley and drawing energy from these large hydro power plants, many of which involve displacing First Nations people in Canada. So there's a really significant amount of resistance to what is essentially a kind of form of greenwashing. So this is why we must think very carefully about what renewable energy really is and what goes into that package.
So part of your book, People's Power, is about Germany's transition to a low-carbon, nuclear-free energy system. I want to spend quite a bit of time with you on this because you contend that it offers many lessons to activism, people's movements today. So how much do renewables account for electricity produced in Germany today?
Well, it depends on how windy it is, but on an average day, it's about 50% of the power in the grid. It can go up to about 65%, and the government would like to have it go up to 80% by the end of the current decade. So there's been really significant increase in renewable energy. Only about 10 or 15 years ago, the amount of renewable energy, and again, that means wind and solar predominantly, in the grid was much lower, less than 10%. So it's really a case of a massive successful transformation.
And how does this transformation, how does Germany's energy transition compare with other large industrial nations?
Well, you know, it's much more significant than what we have in the United States. There are many other nations that have a similar amount of renewable energy in the grid. You know, other European countries have included really significant amounts. And countries in the global south have also made very fast transitions to what gets called renewable energy. As I was doing research for the book, I looked in particular at Uruguay and Costa Rica, that both moved within the space of about a decade to 100% renewable energy. The kicker, though, is that in the case of both of those countries, it's largely based on hydropower, right? So based on dams. That's why I didn't really go into those cases in too much detail, but they are fascinating from a kind of political standpoint in terms of how the transition was made, and there are some interesting similarities to Germany. The thing that really distinguishes Germany from other industrialized countries like the US, Canada, and countries in the European Union is the real significance of grassroots social movements in prompting the transition. So, you know, Germany has a very big coal sector. It's a highly industrialized country. So the kinds of forces that would impede the transition, labor unions of miners, for instance, are very strong in Germany historically. Nonetheless, the country was able to transform, as I said, very, very fast to a really significant extent towards renewable energy. So the thing I set out to explore in this chapter of my book was how this was possible, what made that fast transition to renewable energy possible.
His name is Ashley Dawson. He is professor of postcolonial studies and of English at the Graduate Center, City University of New York, and at the College of Staten Island. We are talking about his new book, People's Power: Reclaiming the Energy Commons. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Now, you do indicate, you do note how quickly and rapidly, I mean, you just mentioned it, the transition in terms of energy in Germany has been. But your historical survey or analysis actually goes back many years. And I want to cover some of that ground with you. So nuclear power in Germany in the post-war decades was important, was significant. What happened to public attitudes in Germany toward nuclear energy beginning in the 1970s or so?
Yeah, as you say, nuclear power was really important. Germany had an economic miracle in the period after World War II. It grew tremendously. A lot of that was based on heavy industry, you know, steel production, automobile manufacture, and a lot of electricity, a lot of energy was necessary for that. So the German government, West German government, built a lot of nuclear power plants. But what happened in the 1960s and 1970s was that movements rose up against that nuclear power. Nuclear power is, as a result of its technical characteristics, extremely centralized, right? You know, you have to have really specialized knowledge and masses of capital to construct a nuclear power plant. And of course, it's also extremely dangerous, as we know, after Chernobyl and Fukushima. And it also can be weaponized. And in West Germany, which was kind of central playing field for the Cold War, with, you know, a lot of US and NATO warheads pointed directly at West Germany, this became a kind of site of cultural and political contestation. And it was also connected to the fact that the states in West Germany that were constructing these nuclear power plants were controlled by a technocratic elite, which had deep roots going back to the Nazi regime, right? So, for instance, in Bavaria, as late as the 1960s, significant percentage of the people working in the state were former Nazis. So the new left, as it developed in Germany, had a very strong anti-authoritarian component. You know, it was based on essentially trying to denazify Germany, German culture, but also the German state. And part of that was to challenge nuclear power and see it as a kind of unjust imposition on the people, something that endangered the people and that was controlled by this tiny elite that was, you know, connected to the big investor-owned utilities in Germany, because the German power sector was set up during the regime of Adolf Hitler and had a very similar structure to the one in the U.S., right? It was a group of investor-owned utilities which were spread across the country. And that arrangement endured into the post-war period. And it was very much an unanswerable structure of power generation and one very much connected to Cold War politics that movements that rose up in the 1960s and 1970s wanted to denounce and to transform in the name of some kind of genuine democratization. So they wanted to actually have people's control over power and to ultimately shut down Germany's nuclear power plants.
In February 1975, there was a proposed nuclear plant construction in the rural town of, and I'm not going to try and pronounce the German here, WYHL. What happened?
Okay, the struggle at Weil was really significant because it helped to forge a coalition that perhaps is a bit surprising. You know, it brought together the kind of anti-war, feminist, queer elements of the German anti-authoritarian left, the kind of extra-parliamentary left that came to be known as the Autonomen, with local people in this rural town, in other words, kind of farmers for the main part, who didn't want to have a nuclear power plant in their backyard. So it helped to forge a real connection between the left and people who might not usually be seen as participating in the left, people who might be seen as having some kind of conservative cultural tendencies, you know, people from cities and people from rural areas. And they united around this demand for democratization of energy supplies. It became known in Germany as Energiewende or energy transition. But this didn't just mean transition from fossil fuels and nuclear power to renewables. It really meant opposition to what people in Germany called the power dictatorship. And this is everything that I was talking about before, this kind of sense of a centralized structure of power generation that had corrupt ties to the state and that had linkages going all the way back to the Nazi era and the actual personnel who staffed this whole thing. So people gathered there to peacefully protest, and the police were sent in to disrupt the protest. And again, you know, the West German police were also not yet denazified. So there was a clear kind of sense on the part of people who were on the receiving end of this oppression that they were facing a real enduring form of dictatorship. And people organized and descended on Weil from all around the country, and it turned into a real mass movement. So the day after the police arrived to try and break up the peaceful encampment of a few thousand people, suddenly there were tens of thousands of people in this small town. The town and surrounding areas very much supported these protests. So it forged a really enduring kind of coalition around demands for energy transformation. And that helped to generate the Green Party, the roots for the Green Party, as well as enduring kinds of extra parliamentary mobilizations against the power dictatorship in Germany.
Now, the Green Party in Germany, was that about or primarily about getting environmental legislation passed, or was it driven more by an effort to or a desire to aid and support environmental activism on the ground?
Yeah, what I found out in my research was that the Green Party, okay, it had specific policies that it wanted to see passed, including ones that were very important for the energy transition, but that it had a much broader view that came out of the kind of extra-parliamentary movements, the Autonomen, that were really fighting for a whole-scale democratization and transformation of German society. So the viewpoint was always much broader than some simple kind of technocratic struggle. And I think this is really important because what I try and do in my book is to keep reminding people that while it's absolutely essential that we shift away from natural gas and coal and oil towards renewable energy, genuine renewable energy like wind and solar power, just shifting those forms of generation isn't going to be enough. What we really need is a wholesale transformation of society, so that the fight for renewable energy has to be part of a broader fight for justice and democracy in our society and in our energy systems, and that those two things go hand in hand. They have to happen together. And so I think that the history of the Green Party in Germany sort of shows us how that could happen. Now, of course, you know, there have been splits and there are different segments in the Green Party, but what I discovered in doing research for the book was that the power of the Green Party in parliament, you know, in the government and in the state, always had to do with its connections to extra-parliamentary movements and with the vibrancy of those extra-parliamentary movements as they put pressure on the Green Party and indeed on other parties in the parliament to come up with genuinely transformational legislations in the energy sector.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Ashley Dawson is my guest. He teaches at the College of Staten Island and at the Graduate Center, City University of New York. He's a member of the Social Text Collective. He's founder of the CUNY Climate Action Lab, and he's a longtime climate justice activist. His new book is People's Power, Reclaiming the Energy Commons. It's published by OR Books. We've got a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. And in your book, you also write about a number of protest movements. There was a protest camp set up in 1977 when local farmers mobilized against a proposed nuclear waste dump site. There were protests in 1981 at a nuclear plant construction site in Brockdorf, Germany, and many other instances of grassroots activism. The issue of these big utilities, these monopolistic large centralized utilities doing kind of their own thing, had to be addressed, as you write, by the state at some point. The state had to require big utilities to move toward renewables in the sense of engaging with small producers that were tapping solar and wind. When did that happen and how did that happen? Like, what prompted the German government to actually take a step like that?
You're right, C.S. There had to be some actual legislation passed. And in Germany, the really decisive shift came in 1991 with the Electricity Feed-In Act. Now, I talk about in the book how that was actually modeled on legislation that came out of the energy crisis in the 1970s in the U.S., you know, passed by administration of Jimmy Carter, who talked about the need to address the energy crisis. He called it the kind of moral equivalent of warfare, right? So in the context of the 1970s, passing legislation in the U.S. that required the people running the grid to take energy from even very small producers of energy was just a no-brainer. And so the legislation in Germany in the early 1990s was very much modeled on that. But again, it wouldn't have come into place without these social movements that were fighting against nuclear power and fighting for different forms of energy. And incidentally, they were also fighting against coal power. So again, going back to my initial points about how difficult this struggle is to win when you have significant sectors of the population, you know, including some labor unions who are kind of dug into fossil capitalism and don't want to let go of that. There had to be a real struggle around this, and the struggle for the idea that there could be some possible future for these folks and for the nation based on renewable energy and on kind of collective control of renewable energy. And the Electricity Feed-In Act helped to give people that sense. It mandated that the people running the grid take energy from whatever source was producing it, no matter how small that energy was. And it also guaranteed a kind of fixed rate of payment for people generating renewable energy so that it could compete with forms of fossil fuel that at the time were cheaper. And so what ended up happening was that this really stimulated a massive boom in citizen-generated renewable energy forms, to the point where about 50% of the renewable energy produced in Germany by midway through the last decade was produced by citizen cooperatives, you know, small groups of people who banded together and were able to put up solar panels or wind turbines. And the other basically 45% of people generating that power came from institutional investors like large pension funds or state-owned banks. So it was really a kind of public sector and citizen-run transition towards renewable energy that benefited people, because it meant that the proceeds from putting that power into the grid could actually come back to the people who are generating the power, right? It wouldn't be going towards CEOs or investors and other fat cats, but rather towards cooperatives of farmers who are, or, you know, people in a city who were able to band together and find the funds to put up solar panels or wind turbines.
What happened in the German village of Feldheim in terms of introducing wind power that you find significant and instructive?
Yeah, the Feldheim case is worth looking at in some detail because it's exemplary of what I'm talking about when I discuss the energy commons. So, you know, one of the dangers of something like wind power is that a big for-profit corporation can go in and set up a wind turbine on someone's land and offer them a small amount of royalties. And, you know, they'll be quite happy to have made something off this big monstrosity in their backyard. Meanwhile, their neighbors will be incredibly angry because they'll see this eyesore in front of them every day, and it will not only mar the landscape, but will also remind them that they're not getting anything out of this resource which their neighbor is benefiting from. So, you know, while we might be thinking of renewable energy as some kind of utopian positive thing that we should struggle for, my point throughout the book is we need to think about structures of governance. We need to think about democratization of this resource if we're going to have the transition move forward. And so Feldheim is really instructive in that regard, because what happened is that the people living in the village, and, you know, it was a village in the German countryside, they're basically farmers living in this village, rather than seeing, you know, just a few people of the village benefit from wind turbines on their land, instead they banded together as a co-op and they negotiated with an energy authority, not one of the big investor-owned ones, incidentally, but with a kind of not-for-profit entity. And so when a series of wind turbines were put up, the proceeds went into a collectively constituted kind of popular bank in the town that led to really concrete improvements in the town, including, for instance, electrification of football fields so that there would be light for people to play football in, but also even more important things like the creation of kind of a biogas plant in the town so that people could use some of the refuse from their farming to also generate electricity. And ultimately, what Feldheim was able to do with the proceeds that they were making from the turbines, you know, from this form of energy democracy in their backyards, was to take over control of the grid, right? So the grid was no longer being run by some outside authority, you know, that was running for profit, but rather they were actually able to control the grid. And this is really important because the arguments that a lot of investor-owned utilities make, and that includes ones here in the United States, is that they can't allow too much renewable energy into the grid because renewable energy is not dependable. You know, it is only around when the sun is shining or when the wind is blowing, and so you can only have a certain percentage in the grid. And so they want to actually slow the transition down, making these kinds of technical arguments about what the grid can bear. So by taking over the grid, the villagers in Feldheim were able to show that, in fact, you could have a massive amount of renewable energy in the grid, and that it wouldn't mean that electricity would crash and that they could actually have meaningful forms of control of their destinies.
That's the voice of Ashley Dawson. His new book is People's Power, Reclaiming the Energy Commons. We'll take a short break and speak more with Ashley about his book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Ashley Dawson is Professor of Postcolonial Studies at the Graduate Center, City University of New York, and at the College of Staten Island. His books include Extreme Cities, The Peril and Promise of Urban Life in the Age of Climate Change, and Extinction, A Radical History. We are talking about his new book out from OR Books. It's called People's Power, Reclaiming the Energy Commons. So you referred earlier to Autonomen, which is autonomous movement in Germany, and how important they were to grassroots struggles and perhaps still are. In the context of Berlin's struggle, the struggle in Berlin to exert public power over the grid, you referred to a grouping called the Berlin Energy Roundtable. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about Autonomen and their philosophy, their and also their praxis, how they want and were able to affect change, and how that might relate to Berlin Energy Roundtable's strategies in relation to Berlin's government as far as trying to return the grid to people's hands.
Sure. So, you know, Berlin, after the collapse of the wall, was a kind of site for all sorts of experiments. It was a site for a lot of extremely radical movements. And I actually have a personal connection because I lived in East Berlin in the 1990 and 1991 period with Autonomen in a squatted house. So, you know, there was a very strong kind of anti-fascist movement that was hoping for some kind of third way, you know, not the totalitarian state socialism of East Germany, but also not the kind of unchained free market capitalism of West Germany and of the U.S. And I remember very clearly when the wall came down and people started seeing ads for cigarette companies called West and similar things, you know, the kind of sense of revulsion that there was going to be this enforced march towards a free market capitalism that would take away some of the guarantees of a decent life that people hoped would come out of the transition and the democratization process. And so the Autonomen, you know, they were a product in West Germany of these anti-authoritarian struggles that I already talked about. And after the fall of the wall, those struggles continued, although they had a very strong kind of anti-capitalist focus. And that focus was intensified in the 1990s because of the shift towards privatization of everything. So Berlin's water supplies were privatized in 1999, and the electric supplies were privatized 2 years earlier. So what the Berlin Energy Roundtable tried to do in the years after its formation in 2011 was to fight back against that privatization process. And it developed in tandem with struggles against other forms of privatization, like water privatization. That struggle had been successful in the early 2000s. The one around energy municipalization or energy democratization took longer and, in fact, was only really successful in 2019, last year. So there was basically a couple of decades that these struggles built. They drew on these much longer fights against power dictatorship, though, that we were talking about earlier in the show, CS, you know, so that kind of legacy of mobilization on the part of not just the left, but alliances between citizen groups and extra-parliamentary movements, and then movements within the state, such as the Green Party and some sectors of the Social Democratic Party in Germany. All kind of came together in the effort to really transform the electricity system in Berlin. So the Energy Roundtable was basically, most of all, trying to make Berlin's energy system once again a public asset, a kind of form of commonwealth. But there were other elements of their push, and that included, of course, the insistence that energy sources be 100% renewable energy. And, you know, going back to another thing that we talked about, that means genuine renewable energy, wind and solar, not something from hydropower. And also another really key element of it was the insistence that the power be affordable. In other words, it was a struggle against energy poverty. Because one of the arguments that had come up in the period after the passage of the Electricity Feed-in Act in the early 1990s was that by subsidizing renewable energy, the German state was essentially engaging in a form of regressive taxation and was, you know, supporting kind of bourgeois solar panels at the cost to the average taxpayer, you know, to people who are not wealthy. And so there's a kind of danger that this could feed into a right-wing populist anti-environmental, anti-renewable energy stance. Of course, this allegation wasn't really true, right? I mean, if the costs of the feed-in tariffs were passed on to consumers, that had to do with the way the state was organizing the taxation structure and the rates being paid by people for electricity, not with any inherent element of the entire setup. However, that was the argument that right-wing forces began making. And so what the Energy Roundtable did was to insist that power should be affordable and that for people who had limited means, power should be cheaper. So the argument made by the Energy Roundtable was that energy was a human right and that nobody should be cut off from their energy supplies. And this is something that's absolutely key all over the place, you know, including in the United States, where hundreds of thousands of people in cities like New York and San Francisco are faced with threats that their power will be cut off by these investor-owned utilities like PG&E in the case of California, or Con Edison here in New York City. And it's also a massive issue throughout the rest of the world, you know, in the global south, where billions of people don't have access to energy in any kind of regular way. So the perception that and the insistence that energy should, you know, a basic amount of energy should be a human right was absolutely key to what the Energy Roundtable was doing. And that was an argument around human rights, but it was also part of a political pushback against a kind of right-wing anti-environmentalist, anti-renewable populism that I think was really important and really exemplary for us here in the United States.
Yeah, what other lessons can we learn from the struggles waged by Germany's energy democracy activists?
One of the key things was that they insisted that public power is cheaper. You know, you don't have to pay off CEOs who make millions of dollars to be running utilities. You're using the money that the utility is generating to help speed the transition to renewable energy. You know, apart from anything else, we also need to be thinking about cutting the amount of energy that we consume. The current system we have is incredibly wasteful. You know, about 40% of the energy that gets generated in big centralized power plants just gets lost. It gets dissipated as heat. So we really need to shift all of that. And the argument that public power is cheaper and more efficient was a key part of what the Energy Roundtable tried to put forward, the message they tried to put into the public sphere. The other thing that they did was to emphasize that public power is democratic, you know, that there could be ways of having a public utility that didn't have to be kleptocratic and unanswerable to public needs. And I think this is really important because it's a kind of challenge to a lot of the arguments that have become dogma in the public sphere today as a result of neoliberalism. You know, the argument that the state can never function effectively, that the private market is nimble and entrepreneurial and highly effective, and that therefore we need to look to private corporations to innovate and to get us to the future we want to get to. So what the Energy Roundtable activists did was to actually insist that that wasn't true, that while the social democratic state had lots of assumptions that were elitist. And, you know, we've already talked about how Germany's post-war state didn't just have elitist assumptions. It also had a lot of Nazis staffing its ranks. But, you know, aside from that really startling and upsetting fact, I think there were also sort of attitudes in social democracy that were pretty elitist. You know, the assumption that you could have a group of highly educated people just take over the state and do what was in the people's good and dictate to the people what they needed. You know, there's a kind of whiff of Stalinism in that kind of attitude of many social democratic regimes. So what the energy democracy activists in Germany and in Berlin specifically tried to do was to come up with structures of governance that wouldn't reproduce those elements of the kind of top-down social democratic state, and of course also wouldn't have all of the flaws of for-profit capitalist corporate power. Some of the innovations that they proposed included the election of a really significant number of citizens to the governing board of the new citizens' energy cooperative, open assemblies whereby citizens could bring their desires and complaints to the governing board, and the role of petitions in generating mandatory conversation around issues. So, you know, if people could put together a series of petitions, they would force the people running the public authority to pay attention to the issues that people were concerned about. So this is really an example of how there was an effort to transform state power and to think about how extra parliamentary initiatives and citizen interests could be brought to bear and help to transform forces that had gained control of the new kind of democratized form of public energy provision. So I think it's a really interesting development and one that is influencing efforts to think through what public power should look like in other places, including here in New York City.
Well, we've been talking about only a portion of this information and insight-filled book. It's called People's Power. It's by my guest, Ashley Dawson. The book is People's Power, Reclaiming the Energy Commons. We have a link to it on againstothegrain.org. I'm C.S. Song. You are not just a professor. You are not just a writer. You are an activist. You're a longtime climate justice activist. And I want to ask you about what your own activist work in New York City currently involves. And we're, again, talking about the intersection of energy and politics and culture.
Yeah, so I've been really fortunate to get involved with a campaign for public power in New York City. And there are very similar campaigns unfolding all around the United States and, of course, in many other parts of the world. But I think what's happened in New York is really interesting because we have this very powerful investor-owned utility, Con Ed, but we also have a kind of legacy of the New Deal in the New York Power Authority. It was set up by former mayor of New York City, Ferrella LaGuardia, and one of New York's governors. And so the campaign for public power began as a pushback against a petition for an increase to be paid by ratepayers, you know, people who are getting electricity from Con Ed. But it very quickly developed into a much more ambitious program. And that was because of just the sense that these investor-owned utilities are really not functioning for the common good. So during the summer of 2019, in the middle of a heat wave, Con Ed cut off power to some of New York City's poorest neighborhoods, neighborhoods that are inhabited by predominantly people of color. And these are parts of the city because of a history of spatial apartheid in the city where people are particularly vulnerable to heat waves. You know, there aren't as many trees, there aren't as many cooling facilities, people aren't wealthy enough to run air conditioners all the time. So cutting off power to those places was a really direct threat to people's lives. So the implications of energy poverty that I've been discussing, and the way that that energy poverty dovetailed with forms of racial capitalism and discrimination, and the kind of resonance with the idea of Black Lives Mattering, all came together. And so the kind of connection of questions around energy to a much broader set of struggles became apparent. And so, you know, what we've been trying to fight for is essentially a kind of dismantling of the investor-owned utility of Con Ed, and in its place, the creation of a public power authority. And that's already a big political struggle because there's so much corruption and Con Ed is so powerful. And some of the other issues that we talked about are also important. You know, workers who work for Con Ed and who are unionized are quite concerned about what would happen if Con Ed disappeared, right? So these issues of just transition and really making sure that people in the fossil fuel sector are guaranteed that their jobs won't go away and that they'll be given good paying jobs when we have a transition, they are all at play in the struggle for public power. And the other kind of interesting connection with the issues we've been talking about together, CS, is the kind of question of what democratization should look like. So in thinking about the case of Berlin, I thought a lot about the work of the philosopher Nikos Poulantzas, who argued that we need to think about the ways in which there have been genuine struggles to democratize parts of the state. You know, parts of the state, like, of course, the police are part of a kind of repressive apparatus and need to be dismantled. But there have been other sectors of the state where there have been some victories for popular struggles over the decades, and how kind of extra parliamentary movements can put pressure on those sectors and really win genuine transformatory initiatives. And so the Campaign for Public Power right now is trying to figure out the specific structures of governance which should control a public power authority in New York State as we struggle to win that authority. And so a lot of the lessons coming out of the Berlin Energy Roundtable about incorporating citizens, allowing social movements to have a voice at the table, and making sure that issues of energy poverty are dealt with, those are all cycling into the conversations that we're having and the legislation we're trying to push forward at the state level right now to establish a public power authority in New York State and New York City.
The final chapter of your book brings up the promise of infinite energy, this idea that the sun is always shining somewhere in many locations around the globe, and the wind is blowing at any particular time in any number of places, so we can tap these sources regularly, more regularly than we need. What's your take on this notion of infinite energy?
Yeah, well, C.S., I bring up that idea because I think it's such an important alternative to ideas of austerity. And that's particularly important today as a result of the pandemic depression and the way that we're having to fight against a new round of austerity. So, you know, if we think about renewable energy, it literally is limitless, right? You know, massive quantities of solar radiation hit the earth every day, and we can tap into those through solar and wind technologies. So potentially, you know, we can get out of the idea of some kind of entropic closed system where we're doomed to austerity and declining resources, and we can provide the power that everyone needs. I think that's a really important note to sound, but I would also sound a cautionary note, and that's what I do in my final chapter, because I think we need to remember that while the energy coming into the Earth system is pretty much infinite, we have to harness that energy using other resources, you know, whether it's the steel that goes into turbines or the lithium that goes into batteries to capture solar power so that we can have access to it when the sun isn't shining. And so what I want to suggest is that we need to be very careful about not beginning a whole new round of extraction and imperialism as we move forward to a future based on renewable energy. We need to continue thinking very carefully about where we get our power from and where we get the resources that that construct the infrastructures through which we harness that power. And just to make this very concrete, you know, think about the lithium that goes into a battery that powers an electric vehicle like a Tesla. You know, it comes from Bolivia at the moment, the vast amount of it. And we know that Bolivia is a country that's been very much under the thumb of U.S. empire. It's a predominantly indigenous country and has fought back valiantly for control of its resources. So I would suggest that we need to make sure that the promise of infinite energy is not one that lulls us into thinking, into forgetting about the history of imperialism, into forgetting that capitalism existed with renewable energies, you know, solar and wind power, long before solar power, and that it was, you know, a brutal system based on slavery. You know, it was slave ships driven by wind power that crossed the Atlantic. So there's the possibility for capitalism and imperialism under renewable energy. And that means that as we think about the common good, as we think about energy as a commons, we need to make sure we're thinking about it in terms of anti-capitalism, anti-imperialism, and decolonization squarely, and keeping those ideas in our minds.
That's Ashley Dawson, professor of postcolonial studies in the English department at the Graduate Center, City University of New York. He also teaches at the College of Staten Island. And we've been talking about his new book, People's Power, Reclaiming the Energy Commons. Ashley, thanks so much for writing this book and for joining us today.
Thank you, C.S. It's been such a pleasure.
And that program first aired last November 30th. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.